Good afternoon, you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Wednesday the 3rd of August, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today on the program we'll talk to Ralph Steves and Julie Spiegel about the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. Jane Lindsay and Christine Crooks will be giving us a preview of the upcoming exhibition of works by local plein air painters this month at the Franklin Street Gallery at the Baranoff Hotel. Talk to Shauna Strasser from Perseverance Theater about this year's schedule of performances, and I'll talk about bears with Ryan Scott from the Department of Fish and Game. That Writer's Almanac, music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. For the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with rain likely later on, low temperatures around 53 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain in the morning, then showers in the afternoon. Thursday night, cloudy skies with scattered showers and a chance of rain on Friday.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The largest repatriation of Native American remains to date in Wisconsin is underway. The State Historical Society is working with three tribes to return several hundred individual human remains from its collection back to the earth. Wisconsin Public Radio's Brian Bull has more.
For more than a century, 261 remains associated with the Forest County Potawatomi, the Menominee Nation, and the Ho-Chunk Nation have been kept within the collection of the Wisconsin Historical Museum, which is part of the State Historical Society. Museum Director Jennifer Kolb says now, thanks to an $88,000 federal grant, it's time to return those remains to their rightful place.
That represents about 40% of the human remains that are at the State Historical Society. Basically, remains that have come over about a 125-year period.
Kolb says when farming took off in the late 1800s, many Native American burial mounds were disturbed. Unearthed remains were often sent to the Wisconsin Historical Society. The National Park Service's grant will help facilitate the return of those remains under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Kolb says the money will be used to hire a project person and also cover travel expenses for tribal elders.
They can tell us where their villages were and their communities. Working together and using all available information, both that the museum and the society can provide, archaeologists can provide, as well as tribal leaders, is so essential.
David Greeno is the Menominee Nation's Tribal Historic Preservation Officer. He says ceremonies will be held to properly rebury the remains in a parcel of land purchased by the Forest County Potawatomi.
Their journeys to the spirit world have been disturbed, interrupted, and they need to go back in the ground so they can continue their journeys to the spirit land.
Organizers expect the repatriation process to take 2 years. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
An Alaska Native Corporation's lands bill could be headed to a U.S. House floor vote. The Sea Alaska legislation has moved farther than ever before in Congress. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Two versions of the Sea Alaska lands bill are before Congress. Both identify timberlands inside Southeast Alaska's Tongass National Forest that could be selected by the corporation, but they differ on some of the parcels. The Senate's version remains in the Chamber's Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where it had a hearing in May. The House version passed out of that body's Resources Committee last month. The vote was 34-10, with bipartisan support. Sea Alaska General Counsel Jaylene Kukesh-Arujo is optimistic.
Because of the vote count being so strong, we feel pretty positive that it will either move on its own or is well positioned to be added to a land bill package. So I think we're very well positioned for success.
The next step could be a House floor vote or a Senate committee markup. Sea Alaska is a Native corporation with about 21,000 Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian shareholders with roots in Alaska's southeast region. Both bills would allow the business to select land outside boundaries set in existing federal legislation. For National Native News, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A 4-day spiritual run for sobriety is underway in Minnesota. Participants started the run Tuesday at a health building on the Red Lake Reservation, which included a smudging ceremony. The relay-style run stretches 200 miles and will end on Friday night with a celebration on the Fond du Lac Reservation. Runners are being encouraged to join any time during the journey. On this day in 1948, a federal court ruled New Mexico had discriminated against Indians by restricting their vote. More than a month earlier, Miguel Trujillo Sr. from Isleta Pueblo attempted to register to vote and was refused. He sued the state and is credited for making it possible for New Mexico tribes to vote in state and national elections. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTLO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Ralph Steves and Julie Spiegel from the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute here to give us a virtual tour of the facility. Thank you very much for coming by the station.
Thank you, and thank you for having us, Jeff.
So before we get into it, first a little bit of history about the facility.
Julie, can you fill us in?
Sure, I can. Thanks. First of all, the Alaska Fisheries Science Center is located actually in Seattle, and we have long had the Auk Bay Lab here in Juneau. So when the Auk Bay Lab started running out of room and they needed updated facilities, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens spearheaded the effort to have the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute built out at Lena Point. And it opened about 4.5 years ago.
How big is it?
There's actually two buildings side by side, and they're both about 3 stories high. And the offices can hold the staff of about 100 people. And the laboratories is the other building. And that, too, is about 3 stories high. And there's chemistry labs, bio labs, and wet labs in that location also.
I imagine there must be a lot of things wrapped up in its mission statement.
It is. You know, Jeff, NOAA is one of those agencies that affect everybody's life on a daily basis. But a lot of times people don't even know what NOAA does. And I'll give you a quick example. And I told my mom I got a contract with NOAA. She lives about 60 miles from Cape Kennedy. And she goes, well, what's NOAA? And I knew she'd get this bridge. So I told her, well, think of NASA, but not space. Think of Earth, ocean, and sky. And she got it.
What makes the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute unique and important?
It's providing science to management agencies about the fisheries in the Bering Sea, the Gulf of Alaska, and down here in the southeast. And they're not actually managing it, but they're providing the science to the agencies that do manage it. And what they're seeking is an understanding of the population of the fish and the condition of the habitat they live in. And hopefully they're going to come up with the kinds of science that will help sustain those fisheries year after year after year, so as not to overfish but still be able to enjoy the resource.
And I would just like to add that Alaska fisheries are known worldwide for being sustainable, healthy fisheries, and it brings in billions of dollars to our state. So if you think about the science that's done at Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute and the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, that's sort of the science behind the success story of Alaska fisheries.
You sound like you give tours every now and then.
Yes, sir. We have public tours open to the public every day at 1 o'clock weekdays, and we will do so through Labor Day weekend, and then there's a possibility we'll go through September.
Are most of the people on the tours locals, or are they a lot of visitors?
The dynamics of the visitor primarily is folks that are from Juneau who have visitors up from the lower 48, and it seems to me when I talk to them, they're doing a very interesting afternoon where they've gone out to the Arboretum, and then they've stopped at the Shrine, and then they stop at NOAA on the way back and give the people a little bit of a slice of Juneau, what's going on here and the kinds of things we enjoy who live here year-round.
What kind of questions do people ask most of the time?
Can you see the northern lights in the daytime in the summer? That's a very frequent question. How much water is going through the system? That's some reason or other, that's a curiosity. And I think the people that are from Juneau have heard something about the water system where we're getting all our heat to keep the building warm from the water that we're using in the wet laboratories before they're discharged back into the ocean. It runs through a system where we extract a little bit of temperature out of a large volume of salt water, and we heat up a small volume of glycol. So basically what's happening is we have 500 gallons of salt water passing through a chamber. On the other side of the chamber is about 20 gallons of glycol, which is like an antifreeze that heats that up to about 120 degrees, and it's the glycol that cycles through the building. And the day that went online back in beginning of March, we shut down our boilers and haven't turned them on since. They're being dismantled, and they're going to be replaced with a small one just for backup. But everybody knows the price of fuel in this town, and this particular science is saving the NOAA an enormous amount of money.
Before we went on microphone, you said that this is a unique community because we have two science hemisphere balls.
We do. That's a good point. There's 62 of those in the world, and Juneau, Alaska is the only city in the world that has two of them. There's one at the Ted Stevens Research Institute, and then there's another one down here next door at the State Museum, excuse me.
And what's the story behind having us two?
Well, the way it's been told to me, and this is before I lived here in Juneau, I used to live up north, that NOAA wrote a grant for the museum to get a science on a sphere, and the museum proceeded to build a little theater that it would be presented in, and when it arrived, the museum wasn't prepared to mount it yet because they were still working on their little theater, and it was sitting around in boxes in the lobby, and powers to be decided, well, let's put it up and take a look at it and see what it looks like. And they did, and then at that point they said, hey, wait a minute, we're keeping this thing. And they went back to the drawing board and wrote another grant so that the museum would have theirs also.
I'm talking with Ralph Steves and Julie Spiegel about the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. What's the nickname for it? What do you call it when you just don't want to say that many words?
Tez Marie.
Can you give us a virtual tour for our radio listening audience, please?
Sure. The folks come in, and it's best to call in advance because I can only take 12 at a time. We go into some fairly confined spots. And the general public comes in, and if there are spots left over before we take off at 1 o'clock, they sign up. I pass out badges, and we do a little introduction nearby the aquariums in the lobby. Then we move over into the office area where I do it for a couple reasons. One is to talk about the difference of air pressures in the three different zones there. The office, for example, when you walk into that section of the building, you can feel wind blowing into your face because it has a higher level of air pressure. And then the lobby is the next highest, and the laboratories are the least pressurized. In fact, they're the same as outdoors. So that's if there's any spillage of any kind of deadly fumes or whatever bad stuff they might be working in one of the labs, the fumes won't go back towards the office but will go out through the fume hoods. So I do that just to increase get another sensation. It's important to use all the senses on any kind of experience that you do. And so we go into the office area, and there's a really nice timeline on fisheries, and I talk about how salmon sort of helped represent the need for statehood back in the 1950s because the salmon stocks had been so poorly managed by the federal government, it kind of became a poster boy for the argument that we want to regulate our own resources. And it's on that timeline that I spend the first 6 or 7 minutes of the tour. Then we go outside and take a look at the water system, and plus it's a beautiful view looking across Friendly Channel and looking back into town. You can just barely see part of northern Douglas Island. And I talk about the water out there. Then I go back to the wet labs and talk about some of the research that's being conducted there. And some days, as the research people are there, they'll take time out of their busy day and explain exactly what they're doing. And that's a nice touch to the tour. We do go into the necropsy lab, which everybody finds fascinating, and myself included. And then we swing by the bio labs and the chemistry labs and then the genetic labs. And I try to schedule so that somewhere along the way we'll stop and talk to one of the scientists. It adds a lot of credibility to the tour because I'm very upfront with the fact that I'm not a scientist. I'm an educator who loves science and loves sharing it.
Sound like you enjoy your job.
I love my job.
I've been talking to Ralph Steves and Julie Spiegel about the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. Tours go on every day at 1 o'clock?
Every day at 1 o'clock. And it runs about 1 hour and 10 minutes, depending upon how much coffee I've had that day.
What number should people call you at to reserve their seat of 12?
Yeah, we're 789. My phone number is 789-6050. And it's best to call in advance so that I've had to have people miss the tour because I just can't take more than 12. And that's a safety factor. Plus, I've learned, Jeff, that the more people you have after 5, you're going to have to start adding minutes here, minutes there, because you can only get so many people through a door at a time. And it accumulates as you pass through different stages of the tour.
And phone number one more time, please.
Sure. It's, of course, 907. Everything is 907. 789-6050.
Ralph and Julie, is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, I'd like to say it's a pleasure meeting you, sir. I hear your voice day after day, and it's really an honor to sit here in this chair and talk with you about something that I care about greatly. And thank you for being here today, Julie.
Oh, thank you, Ralph.
I'm honored that you could make it here today, and I look forward to visiting the facility one day myself.
Please come out.
Ariel, listen to me. The human world is a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything they got up there. The seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more is you looking for? Under the sea, under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While we be boating full time to floating under the sea. Down here or the fish is happy as after the waves go roll. The fish on the land is happy. It's hard cause they in the bowl. But fish in the bowl is lucky. They in for a worse fate. One day when the boss get hungry, yes, you go beyond the pay. But no, under the sea, under the sea. Nobody beat us, fry us, and eat us in fricassee. We watch the land folks loves to cook. Under the sea, we have to hook up. We got no troubles, life is the bubbles. Under the sea, under the sea. Since life is sweet here, we got to be here naturally. Even the sturgeon and the ray, the earth start to play. We got the spirit, you got to hear it. Under the sea. Play the flute, the top, play the harp, the players play the bass and they sound the chop, the bass play the brass, the chop play the tub. The flute is the duke of soul. The way he can play the lays on the fringe, the tub cracking on the blackfish. He sings his belt and his butt. They know where it's at. They know that blowfish blow.
From the Little Mermaid, the time is 3:18, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. This Friday, there's a lot of things going on. The first Friday of this gallery walk, one of them is the Franklin Street Galleries at the Baranoff Hotel exhibit of the Plein Air Painters. Jane Lindsay and Christine Cooks are here in the studio to talk about it. Thank you so much for coming down the station.
Thank you.
Oh, we're always happy to come.
So can you describe the Plein Air, or the Plein Rain, as some people call it?
Yes, well, we actually call ourselves the Plein Rain Painters, primarily because we're in Juneau and there's so much rain. Plein Air is the French term for people who paint outdoors, and we paint outdoors year-round, rain or shine. It's sort of a loose association of, about 25 people come and go during the years. Barbara Craver and Pua Maunu started this back in 2000, and it's just a drop-in if you can show up on Saturday mornings at the A&P Foodland area. You stop by, get your coffee and pastry, and we sort of look out the windows there and say, well, where shall we go today? So it's anybody who feels like coming at 9 o'clock, and we go from there. Sometimes there's two or three people. We've been known to buy fruit and vegetables at A&P and do some still life. lives right there if the weather's really bad. But we do this year-round, and we really encourage people who've thought about going out and doing plein air painting, that it's very different to go outside, especially year-round, and paint this beautiful town. And it's funny, but winter here is actually quite good. You only go out for about an hour and a half because it might be, you know, in the upper 30s, but it's frequently sunny and you see shadows and it's bright and the snow has a lot of reflection. So it's a lot of fun even to go out in the winter time. So we encourage folks to join us.
And I also think it's really good to say that there's no hierarchy here. You can be pretty much at any level, and you can find somebody who's using the materials that you're either interested in using or you want to try. And we all are pretty supportive of just, let's get out and let's paint and let's try to make a painting. And what is that all about? So if you're thinking of coming out and you're thinking, oh, I'm not good enough, or I'm, you know, at this level, you know, get your paints together and come down and meet the group, because it's a pretty supportive group.
Right? Would you say most of the painters are realists or abstraction expressionists or what?
That's a good question. We are a wide variety. Some are very abstract, some are very realistic, and then the full range in between. And the funny thing, people who've worked with us before said typically people who paint together for, you know, 5-10 years, you tend to get one style, but we all have very distinctive styles even yet. So we encourage people to find their own way.
And that's a good question, Jeff, mostly because I think I can answer it in relationship to Kes, is why we like having Kes come down, and why he's mentioned that he likes to come down and work with us, is because we are a group that's pretty much willing to try anything in terms of an exercise, which means that we aren't really going out saying, I'm a realist, or I must capture the light, or I must do this abstractly. We're kind of out there because we like it and it's a challenge. So I think it works for us in that sense very well.
Well, and that's the show that is going to open this Friday. There were 17 people, Juno artists, who took the workshop. It was 2 3-day sessions. A lot of us were able to take both sessions. And Kes said he's not really a plein air painter per se. He does paint outside, but he does a lot of his finish work in the studio. And Kes does really large. He's very well recognized as a wonderful professional artist. But his job was to take us out of our comfort zone. So he would give us these tremendous assignments like, okay, today you can do whatever you want, but don't use green. Well, you know, in the summer in Juneau, it's almost everything is green. So it's
pretty darn green.
So the paintings, I think, that people will see should be very interesting. We were all challenged to take them back inside and try to finish them up enough so that they could be, you know, shown in this exhibit. And maybe some people went further than others and have a completed picture. But we just wanted to have a chance to look at them all together and sort of see what came out of this.
And the Kes you're talking about is Kes Woodward, who's got a long legacy of Alaskan participation in art here in the capital city as well as the Anchorage area.
Absolutely, yes. He was a curator here at the Alaska State Museum. He was a professor in the university in Fairbanks. He's a historian. He's written a number of books. I think recently when he was here, he spoke about Sidney Lawrence. He's an Alaskan art historian. And we basically twisted his arm to get him here because he doesn't really do workshops. But I think because of the connections he's had in Juneau, it's always a pleasure to come back. And we do pay him a stipend and pay his way, and he works us hard.
What kind of things did you learn from Kes?
You know, for me, he said it's really easy in such a beautiful place as Alaska to make pretty pictures. And a lot of times our visitors and tourists do enjoy going back with a pretty picture of Alaska. But he was challenging us to say, what is it that you want to say about this place? What? Start with your statement before you even do a thumbnail sketch, before you think, what is your emotion today? Write it down and then try to use that to guide whatever you might do. And sometimes you don't always end up with a really pretty picture. You might have been emphasizing how gray the clouds were today or something. And so for me, that was a real interesting break from just trying to make a tree look like a tree, perhaps.
Yeah, and I agree with Christine. I think that Kess has a really good way of saying we're not going to use gimmicks to make this painting. It's quite challenging to be out there for an hour or two and look at anywhere, look at a landscape and come up with a composition and go for it and make it work and make it get somewhere that you can say, I understand this, and now I can either take it back to the studio or I've done it. So he breaks those gimmicks, and at the same time, he challenges us in ways, I think, that sort of teach you the basics. Think about a composition. Think about shapes. Paint what you see, not what you know. So, you know, in the sense, like, we know it's beautiful, but what's really going on there, you know, and how do we not be arbitrary with our color, and how do we look at all of this green that we see all the time and see it differently or in a new way? So he's very challenging, and it's not about a gimmick. And, it, you know, I don't have a background in plein air painting at all or landscape painting, but it's pretty exciting to go out there, and it's very challenging, and to not get frustrated or overwhelmed and sort of stick with it and become engaged is a great, great treasure. And to have somebody and a group that helps you get that is really nice.
I'm talking to Jean Lindsay and Christine Cooks about the plein air painters who are going to be showing their artwork this Friday from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Franklin Street Gallery at the Baranoff Hotel. 16 artist totals?
17, only 16 have decided to show.
But, do you have their names you want to share?
Yes, I do. I have a cheat list so I can remember. It's Barbara Craver, Constance Baltuck, Christine Crooks, David Riccio, Jane Stokes, Jim Heumann, Mary Ann Slemons, Monica. Oh, no, I don't think Monica. She's moved out of town, so she's not going to be showing. Nancy Brown, Patty Harper, Paul Volkers, Pua Ma'unu, Sarah Dunlap, and Jane Lindsay.
And I understand you're also going to have calendars available.
Yes, you know, we've had this plain rain calendar for almost 10 years. And since we were going to have the show, we decided to print it up so Christmas in August. So if people are interested, we do have both refills and the frames, and they'll be there at the Franklin Street Gallery Friday.
And the big question, what's for food?
Food is food for the eyes and the soul. There's a wine tasting at the Baranoff, but I'm afraid we don't have treats.
It's okay that the treat for the soul will be fine.
Are you going to come if there's no treats?
I think I might. All right, Jane and Christine, thank you very much for coming down the station.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 3rd of August, 2011. It's the birthday of Carrie Barry, born in Atlanta, 1854. She was just 7 years old when the Civil War began. She kept a diary. And from her diary, which is very sweet, even in the midst of terrifying events, we can know more about everyday life in the South. She writes about General Sherman's march to the sea and the burning of Atlanta. And she also writes about school and studying arithmetic, spelling, reading, and geography, and how her teacher, Miss Maddie, told the children that they knew their multiplication tables very, very well. It was on this day, 1527, the first known letter from the New World to the Old was sent to King Henry VIII of England by his sea captain, Master John Rutt, who Henry had sent to command an expedition to North America in search of the Northwest Passage to Asia. He was on a boat called the Mary Guildford. It had a rough crossing of the Atlantic. It explored the coast of Labrador and then came into harbor at the port of St. John's on Newfoundland, where on August 3rd, Master Rutt wrote to King Henry VIII, that we found many great islands of ice and deep water. The expedition had gone out on the mistaken belief that no matter how far north you sailed, seawater could not possibly freeze, and John Rutt was finding that this was not true. There in the harbor of St. John's, he found 11 Norman fishing boats, one from Britain and two from Portugal, and he turned his boat to the south, and he sailed toward Florida. It was on this day, 1841, Juliana Horatia Ewing was born in the village of Ecclesfield in Yorkshire, England. She loved to make up stories for her siblings based on Hans Christian Andersen and the Grimm brothers. She wrote plays for her siblings. When she was 18, she founded a lending library and then began her publishing career, writing stories for magazines. Her book, The Brownies and Other Tales, was very popular, practically unknown today, but immensely popular in her time. And the founders of the Girl Scout movement named their junior-level scouts Brownies in honor of her. Here's a poem for today by Marianne Larkin, The Last Summer. The children know it, the way they call to each other, and the way they gather to trim the branches, as at old rituals, their gentleness. When we were young, they say. The father, stooped as they are straight, goes from one to another, names them, consults the dog's leg, some car trouble, always an object between them. He sits among them this summer in his old T-shirt. His body absorbs them. The mother laughs often this summer, teases their friends. My daughter gave me, my son helped me, she tells me. She spins around them, ties up her plants, has them paint and paper. She thinks it'll be nice for them. There may be a wedding, who knows, 5 still at home, but not for long. She is the bravest. She says it, if only to herself. It is the last summer, she says. It is the last summer. The Last Summer, poem by Marianne Larkin from The Coil of the Skin, published by Washington Writers Publishing House and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith, written by Priscilla Kinter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:32, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are involved with the STAR program from Perseverance Theater. We have Shona Strasser, who has worked with the program for a number of years, and also Edgar and Malik, who are performers in this year's performances. Thank you very much for coming down to the station, everybody.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
Thanks.
Shona, can you give us an overview of the STAR program?
Yeah, sure. The STAR program is run through Perseverance Theater. It stands for the Summer Theater Arts Rendezvous. It's a theater camp for ages 10 to 18. And we started about 4 weeks ago. We rehearse every day from 1 to 5. We have skills building sessions, acting, voice, and physical training. And then we break off into our rehearsal. We're doing 2 separate shows. We're doing Beauty and the Beast, which is the musical, a huge musical. And we're also doing James and the Giant Peach, which is based on the Roald Dahl book.
About how many people are involved in the programs?
There's about 45 kids. And
how do you do that?
What?
How do you manage them all?
I hire really great people. And we try to focus on having a lot of fun. So the kids are just really, they're all really great. I mean, we just have a lot of fun together. We listen to each other. We work together. We talk about how to comment on each other's artistic choices and it's fun. It's not that hard. I mean, you know what I mean.
It's fun.
It's fun, exactly.
And we have some performances coming up this weekend?
Yeah, we open Friday night. Beauty and the Beast opens Friday night, and then James and the Giant Peach opens Saturday night. So.
And Edgar and Malik, you're also two of the actors in which play?
We are both in James and the Giant Peach.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you play, Edgar?
I play a narrator.
and I play the earthworm.
Well, I'd like to have our participants in the program here to recite a line or two from their favorite line from
please,
the play.
Please, in your best acting voices.
Edgar, you first, please.
It was at this point that the first thing, the rather peculiar thing, happened to James.
And my favorite line would be, "Nothing is ever all right in the end, and you well know it."
Wow.
That's a great line.
What have you learned from the STAR program this year?
I've learned a lot about acting because I haven't really acted a lot. And I've learned lots about how to pose in different ways and speak loudly and project my voice and stuff.
Are you doing very well today?
It's true.
Malik?
Well, this is actually my third year in STAR. I would say, that's a tough one, what I actually learned this year.
What's different about your character this year than in years past?
I would say this is the first year that my character hasn't been real in charge. So it's interesting acting like someone who isn't always telling other people what to do. So I'm learning how to do that.
What kind of advice would you have for people who want to be actors?
To want to be actors. Well, probably start small and work big. And yeah.
Malik?
I would say learn to control your energy when you're not on stage.
Yeah, that's
a big
good,
one.
That's a really good one, Malik.
And don't talk backstage.
All right. These performances are a win again, Shana?
Well, we've got 2 weekends of performances. So we have shows Friday, Saturday. We have 2 shows Saturday, show on Sunday, and then we start again the next weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And for a full schedule, you can check Perseverance Theater's website, and that's perseverancetheater.org, and you can see all the... We're doing 4 performances of each show, so it's the kids get an opportunity to do a show and then... actually get better and at their performance in front of audience.
Yeah, I've heard that when you teach something, you get a little something back yourself. What have you gotten back, Shona?
Laughter. We do a lot of laughing, which is really great. I mean, I laugh with adults, of course, but it's different when you laugh with Edgar here because, I mean, on our entire car ride over here, we talked a lot about snarfing, which is always funny. You know, like if milk comes out of your nose. They didn't know the technical term for it, which I taught them today. So, you know, things like that. It's things that you don't always talk to adults about.
I bet you're popular with parents, too.
Everybody learns something.
All right. And that website is perseverancetheater.org.
That's right. And you can get tickets at the door. And the shows are all out at the pavilion out at the UAS, so that outdoor space up there. It's not utilized very much, so we actually put a full set up there and full costumes and everything. So.
All right, Jonas Strasser and Edgar and Minleek, thank you very much for coming down the station. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Not that I can think of.
Nope.
Thanks, Jeff.
time is 3:41, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. A few weeks ago, we thought it would be a fun idea to collect bear stories from local people here about what their experiences with those big Bruins are. And we got a few recordings, and we've been playing it back over the past few days on KTUO's Juneau afternoon. Here's our latest one.
Hi, this is Katie Chapman, and I want to tell my bear story. So a couple of years ago, I just moved into my new place out of North Douglas, and the first weekend that I was home, I locked the door before going to bed, and then later, about 3 in the morning, I woke up to a loud pounding, and it sounded like someone was stomping down my stairs and onto my porch, and then I heard scratching at the door, and I started to feel a little bit scared, but my door was locked, so I thought it was okay, and then suddenly there was a loud banging sound, and I heard my door, my locked door, swing open. So I'm up in my loft, totally scared, not feeling comfortable quite yet to jump out of the window and possibly get injured. I thought that it was an intruder, but then after I heard heavy breathing and growling and I could smell the bear, I realized it was a bear at that point. And I honestly was a little less afraid knowing it was a bear and not some man. But I was still terrified because I'm stuck up in my loft and the bear is beneath me, in my kitchen, throwing food around off my shelves and getting into my garbage. After what seemed like forever, the bear finally left, and I crawled down the stairs, and I cried, and I called my mom in Illinois if she could do something. Anyway, there was garbage all over. There was bear hair, big, wet bear paw prints, and I found a steak knife all chewed up on the floor. So now I have a deadbolt on the door, and I sleep with a rifle under my bed.
Well, we've had so many comments about the bear series that I'd invite Brian Scott from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to talk about the various things about bears, and also particular what to do if you run into a bear in a kitchen or in the forest. Brian, thank you very much for being on the show with me today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So, first of all, how many bears are there about in Juneau?
We have no idea. Nobody does. Bears aren't like moose and goats where we can count them easily from an aircraft or even, you know, the road system or a boat. But based on observation and the number of bears people see and some of the harvest data, you know, it appears that we grow bears very well around the Juneau area.
More black bears than brown bears?
Very much so. Especially in urban areas, black bears are the norm. We do have pockets of brown bears a little bit off the road. Once you get to roughly Cowie Creek, that's kind of the mixing zone. So you're just as apt to see a brown bear as a black bear out that way. But in town and around the neighborhoods, it's predominantly black bears.
Would you say this an above average year or a below average year?
Well, we've been discussing that kind of internally in amongst our staff, and it's an above year, I would say. And I'm not sure if we're, you know, we're getting a lot of contacts in the office about bear activity around Juneau. It also seems like we have a lot more bears visible. The other thing that stands out is that we have a lot of young bears. And when I say young bears, those bears that are like a year and a half old, they've just recently been kicked out by their mothers. And they're, you know, they're kind of lost in the world. They're trying to figure out where they stand and how to move around and how to function in the bear society. It also means that they don't know the rules very well. And a lot of times those guys generate a lot of our calls and the contacts. These bears tend to be a little bit more pushy, and they also seem to be a little bit more curious, so they find themselves in predicaments a little more often than adults.
What do people say on the calls? Are they saying, like, help, there's a bear right here? Or?
Yeah, we get the whole gamut. A bear is walking through my backyard. I saw a bear out the glacier. There's a sow and a cub walking down the road. So we get a lot of things, you know, and that's good. People should always feel comfortable calling us and talking to us about bears or asking questions, certainly if they have any concerns about what's going on.
And I understand the last possible resort is actually eliminate the bear, but there's other solutions before that.
There's lots of solutions. And certainly Fish and Game is, you know, we don't sit there ready to go deal with a bear directly. We spend a lot of time trying to sort out what the bear is up to, identifying what might be attracting it to a certain area, and working with homeowners to come up with solutions to keep bears out of whatever it might be. Now, that said, there are times when Fish and Game does need to respond, you know, right away.
What should one do what should one do to prevent bears coming into their neighborhood? I mean, you can't stop cooking food, because a lot of the stories we've been getting are people just living their normal lives. They haven't been doing anything wrong necessarily about leaving their garbage out, but bears have been able to get into their kitchen, whether there have been a window open or their bathroom.
Yeah, and those things are pretty tough. You're right. You know, we can't go quit living our lives just because we have black bears. I think it's recognizing that we do live in a place with a lot of black bears, and we do have, you know, a certain number of bears in close proximity to people. I would reiterate things we talk about all the time. You know, no garbage, no attractants, no food, no birdseed, no pet food. If you've got a smoker or fruit trees even, things like that, put an electric fence around them. Otherwise, keep all that other stuff secure. There are times, and this summer is a great example, when bears are going to do things that are inappropriate. Go in through a bathroom window, get into a vehicle, things like that. When that kind of stuff starts to happen, there are options that we have, you know, including electric fences that we loan out. We have electronic deterrent devices that we loan out. And there are times when we go address the specific animal. But it takes a little while for that to kind of shake out, to be honest with you. If we're trying to sort through 10 or 15 bear calls in an area, we try to work out and identify which specific animal we need to address. We don't want to go out and just start removing bears.
You can, however, relocate them?
We can. You know, anytime we do that, it takes a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of personnel. And we have to do it the right way. It has to be a long distance away, and there has to be a lot of water between us and the bear for it to work. Otherwise, generally what we see are bears come back.
What are the most common areas in town that we might run into a bear?
Yeah, right now there's a lot of bear activity downtown. We've got a couple females with cubs and yearlings that are very active. Out in the Lena Point area, Tea Harbor area, we've got quite a bit of activity. And the valley has been strangely quiet most of the summer, but we have gotten several calls from there over the last couple of days, so we'll see if that kind of turns on.
I imagine barbecuing fish is not necessarily the best idea this time of year.
Actually, it's a great idea, especially when it's summer, but you got to clean up. You know, you don't want to leave. You go out and go fishing. You don't want to leave fish scraps out and about, for sure. If you can, fillet them at the harbor, or fillet them and take the carcasses and get rid of them somehow. If you can't do any of that, put them in a plastic bag, throw them in a freezer till garbage day, put them out on garbage day.
So what happens if you run into a bear in the forest or maybe in your kitchen? What should you do?
Yeah, you know, running into a bear out in the woods is, first off, it's kind of a neat thing to be able to have the opportunity to see bears. And if we approach those situations with a little bit of knowledge, we can enjoy it, and we can enjoy the resource, which is what we want to do. We recommend people travel in groups when you can. Keep your head on a swivel. You know, if you're walking down a trail and you start seeing bear scat all over the place, it's a pretty good indication that bears are there. Make noise. You know, sing. I look like an idiot in the woods sometimes because I'm walking through areas clapping my hands and singing songs and talking just to let the bears know I'm there. Most likely, you won't ever see the bear. It'll know you're coming, and it's going to take off. So just a little bit of common sense. And if you do bump into a bear, you know, I always I try to tell people, don't freak out. Just because you see a bear doesn't mean it's a terrible situation. You know, try to assess what's happening. If the bear is moving away, fine, let it go. If the bear doesn't notice you and it's, you know, a couple hundred yards away, leave. Or come back another time, or, you know, give it a wide berth, whatever. If the bear does show some attention to you, clap your hands, talk to the bear, stay calm, talk to it in a normal voice, identify yourself as a human. Most bears don't want to interact with people.
What about if you run into one in your house?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a different situation, obviously. When bears go into homes or cars or, you know, any other enclosure or something that you don't necessarily want them to be, a lot of the same things apply. Trying not to get overly excited, which is very difficult, and I recognize that, but talk to the bear, clap your hands, hey bear, you know, you need to get out of here. Now, one thing that we try to encourage people when we're working through these types of situations on the phone with the homeowner or with the police department or whatever, opening doors to let them out, because most bears don't want to be there, you know, if they're stuck, and they'll take off as soon as the first opportunity they have. But people need to think about their safety. You know, get to a room where they can close the door and not interact with the bear. Call the police or call Fish and Game, and you'll get help that way, for sure.
And you should not run away from the bear, because bears can run faster than you can.
Right. Yeah, don't run away. You know, encourage the bear to leave. If the bear is really inquisitive, there's a time, and there's no, you know, mark X that delineates that time. But there is a time where you need to be quiet and let the situation diffuse and the bear leave. It's very, very rare.
I've been talking with Ryan Scott from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game about bears in general and bears in downtown Juneau in particular. You want to recap the ways of preventing bears coming into your house or area?
Yeah. You know, some of them are very basic stuff. You know, keep your doors closed, keep your windows closed, keep car doors locked, keep car doors rolled up or car windows rolled up. I recognize that on warm sunny days we all like to have windows open and, you know, garages open, things like that, and it's great. I do it too. If you live in an area, and you probably know it at this point, if you're in an area with a lot of bear activity, just be cognizant of it. Pay attention to what's going on. Think about it, and if a bear's around, close those things up, and most of the time that'll keep them out.
And if people do run into a bear and want to call Fish and Game, what is the phone number to call?
465-4265.
But the best thing to do is to prevent it from it being a problem in the first place.
It is, you know, and we start in the spring, early spring, encouraging people, just kind of tuning folks up that we're coming into the bear season. The attractants, you know, human food, human garbage, pet food, bird seed, all that kind of stuff needs to be secured. And that eliminates a lot of the issues.
Ryan Scott, thank you so much for coming in today on short notice.
Thank you, Jeff.
night is dawning, she's back in her place. And I start each day with a smile on my face. 'Cause nobody knows that we've been anywhere. Me and Angela Bundy, my dancing brown bear.
Angelina, your host of Tideline on Wednesday nights, 5 to 7 on KRNN. I play a diverse mix of Americana, country roots rock, and southern swamp stomp. I often have musicians stop by for a chat and a song in the studio. That's Tideline Wednesday nights, 5 to 7 on KRNN 102.7.
Of Tony Bryce ending out this program for the Juneau afternoon today. You are tuned to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AL at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sirsuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on DCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon, we'll talk with Fumi Matsumoto and Gene Terry about their art show, Pathways, opening with a reception Friday at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. Tasha Whalen and Lenka Farabee will be here to talk about them being selected as this month's featured artist at the Juneau Artist Gallery. We'll talk with Mitch Watley about his solo show, The Ruby Room, this month. And we'll get news and views about other local art during Arts Up with Nancy Chichurny from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. It's tomorrow 3 here on KTOO News. Weather forecast for tonight, rain likely later on, low temperatures around 52 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain with high temperatures around 60 degrees. Rain likely Thursday evening and Friday, looks like mostly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and high temperatures around 59 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today. If you'd like to be on a Juneau Afternoon or you know someone that should be, please give me a call. My name is Jeff Brown. The phone number is 463-6425.